to the blind man, it's down to the left child. We will survive in this country wilderness. Swimming through the waters of Babylon like a rebel fish. Journalist, specialist, predator and survivalist. Spitting heaven fire from his lips. Burn the same driver.
Welcome, listeners, to Time for an Awakening on Black Talk Radio Network, New Media for the New Millennia. This is a history and current events program from a cultural perspective. We find this program necessary because Hosea 4:6 states, "My people are destroyed for the lack of knowledge." But we as a people can turn this around. Proverbs 4:7 states, "Wisdom is the principal thing. Therefore, get wisdom. And with all that getting, get an understanding." Again, welcome to the program this evening with your hosts, Brother Elliot and Brother Richard. The number to reach us to join the conversation this evening is 215-490-9832. That's 215-490-9832. We're streaming live at several locations. You can go to timeforanawakening.com, which is the homepage, and catch the live stream from that location. You can go to www.blacktalkradionetwork.com/timeforanawakening. Again, that's www.blacktalkradionetwork.com/timeforanawakening and catch the live stream there also. You can go to ourradionetwork.com. Again, that's ourradionetwork.com/timeforanawakening. They broadcast out of the Black Belt and catch the live stream there. Or you can download TuneIn to any of your handheld devices. TuneIn is a free app. And in that TuneIn search engine, just type in Time for an Awakening. There you'll see the icon and you can stream the program live, even into your car if you have the Bluetooth capabilities or the auxiliary connection. Again, that's Time for an Awakening radio program with the live stream on the TuneIn app. Drop us an email at timeforanawakening@gmail.com. That's timeforanawakening@gmail.com. Time for Awakening also has a fan page on Facebook. In that Facebook search engine, just type in Time for an Awakening radio program. There you always see interesting content being posted daily. And do me a favor before you leave that page, just hit that like button. That's Time for an Awakening radio program with the fan page on Facebook. And Time for Awakening Media is there. Always full of the latest podcast on Time for an Awakening and interesting articles that you can read, download at later times, or even share with your friends. So again, make that one of your favorites. Put that in your address bar. That's timeforanawakening.com. Timeforanawakening.com will take you straight to Time for an Awakening Media. Tonight, it's Friday here in the city of Philadelphia. It's 8:11 Eastern Standard Time, and we usually have Freestyle Friday on Friday, where we can just bounce around the latest issues of the week, some topics that's on your mind. We'll still be able to do that, but first we want to have a discussion.
Perfect.
With
Hold on a second. I'm sorry about that.
With one of our students out there in UCLA. Isaiah Njoku, and I hope I'm not messing up Isaiah's name, and he'll be on with us. He's head of the Black Student Union out there in UCLA, and it was an article that I read in Atlanta Black Star about the Black Student Union pushing a list of demands on the university out there. So we're going to talk to Brother Isaiah in reference to what's going on with our students on the UCLA campus. I don't think it's much different if you've been following the news, what's going on a lot of these college campuses in relation to Black students there and their struggle for respectability on a lot of these college campuses. We're going to get into that conversation with our guest this evening, among other things, and we'll be right back to get the program started after a brief word from our sponsors.
Mr. Moderator, distinguished guests, brothers and sisters, our friends and our enemies. Everybody is here.
You are listening to Time for an Awakening Media, part of the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasts or live programming, hit them up at timeforanawakening.com.
All Insurance Incorporated, an African-American owned and operated insurance agency in business for over 20 years, located at 231 Southeastern Road in Glenside, PA, with other offices in Germantown and West Philadelphia. Call now for commercial insurance quotes, homeowners insurance quotes, automobile insurance quotes, notary and tax services, representing over 15 major A-rated insurance companies, offering a discount on all notary services when you call in for a free quote. Call this number, 215-885-2444. That number is 215-885-2444. 215-885-2444. All Insurance Incorporated.
Before your roof becomes unruly, call Dooley. Dooley Brothers, specializing in shingle, rubber roofs, gutters, downspouts, and vinyl sidings. Call for your free estimate today. 215-224-3882. That's 215-224-3882. Dooley Brothers Roofing, the roofing experts you can trust. That number again, 215-224-3882. 215-224-3882. Before your roof becomes unruly, call Dooley.
RG Electrical Inspections provides electrical inspections for realtors, licensed electricians, and homeowners. Licensed and insured underwriter, serving Philadelphia and surrounding area. Call today, 484-268-9837.
Overworked? Suffering with an underperforming company, headache customer, staff, or vendors? Or are you a startup who wants to get it right the first time and avoid the costly mistakes? We turned a $24,000 a year odd job handyman service into a seven-figure high-end custom home builder and commercial contractor licensed and operating in three states. This is just one transformation created for entrepreneurs like you in various industries around the country. Not what you're used to from accounting and business consulting? Well, welcome to New Business Solutions. If you're ready to go beyond advising, coaching, and training and get implemented results, call 301-244-9072. Let New Business Solutions apply the best comprehensive administrative, accounting, operations, human resources, management, sales, and marketing to help you actualize your vision for yourself and your company. From anywhere nationally, call 301-244-9072, spelled new as in numerous, on your device right now. Book your free consultation at newbusinesssolutions.com.
History is a clock that people use to tell their political and cultural time of day. It is also a compass that people use to find themselves on the map of human geography. History tells of people where they have been and what they have been, where they are and what they are. Most important, history tells a people where they still must go, what they still must be. The relationship of history to the people is the same as the relationship of a mother to her child.
From antiquity to the present, our people need to develop a new paradigm. It's time for an awakening. With your host, Brother Elliot. Sundays, 7 p.m., Fridays at 8 p.m. For podcasting or live program scheduling, hit us up at timeforanawakening@gmail.com. Welcome back to Time for an Awakening. And before we get started with our program this evening, I want to welcome in my co-host, Philadelphia activist and tour guide at the African American Museum here in Philadelphia at 7th and Arch Street, Brother Richard. Is with us, Brother Richard.
Yes, sir, Brother Elliot.
How are you, sir?
I'm doing fine. It's Friday, and I'm kind of, and I'm again always as what happens here on Time for Awakening. I'm really interested to speak to Brother Isaiah, and or at least listen to what's going on there at UCLA. Another manifestation of students showing leadership and pushing forward change. In an institution, which might be a lot of good examples for us in the community of what we can do or should be doing.
Yeah, we're getting a little bit. we're getting a little bit of distortion on your end, Richard. If you can keep an eye on your equipment there. I think it might be that little connection might be bad, but we're going to fight through it. It's just getting just a little interference. It ought to be interesting discussion, Richard, because what's happening out there from what I read in the Atlanta Black Star is similar to what's going on in a lot of these other college campuses that are not HBCUs. We see a lot of this blatant racism going on between a quote-unquote younger generation. This stuff is not going away, Richard. Some of our people are under the illusion that this stuff is just going to disappear like maybe smoke in a room. It doesn't work like that. It's going to take our people in act. It's going to take action to cause change. And the change is really in the minds of our people. The real work is going to be in the minds of our people, convincing our people that it's necessary to fight the powers that be in this country for independence of our people, physical and mental. It's going to be work, Richard. Let's reach out to our guest this evening, Brother Isaiah. Brother Isaiah, are you with us?
Yes, sir. Good evening. How is everybody doing tonight?
How are you, sir?
Great.
I'm doing wonderful. Thank you for asking.
Brother Isaiah, let me, because I don't want to, is that Njoku?
Yes, Isaiah Njoku.
Good. Wow. I got to pat myself on the back there. I didn't butcher your name. Brother Isaiah, I'm glad to have you with us, man, to talk about what's going on UCLA campus. I made mention before you came on that, you know, some of the things that I read in Atlanta Black Star, a lot of these things going on your campus is similar to things going on at a lot of college campuses from the West Coast to the East Coast, as far as the disrespect of the people there, our young people there on the college campuses. Before you kind of get started, to let us know what's going on at UCLA and what you're doing there, what you're doing in reference to it, talk a little bit about yourself, Isaiah. The year that you're in, what you're majoring in, and just a little bit of background on yourself.
Of course. So I'm currently a fourth-year student, a second-year transfer, so I'll be graduating at the end of this quarter. I'm majoring in sociology and minoring in public health, and I transferred from Santa Monica College in Los Angeles. I was born and raised. We went to Culver City High School. Love to play basketball, sing, write music, and obviously be an activist and fight for our community. So that's a little bit about myself.
So you got game, Isaiah? You on the team or what?
I got a little something. I wasn't able to be on the team because I didn't want to commit that much time
okay.
to basketball. I do got a little game.
Okay, just a little light, just kidding around, Isaiah. Isaiah, listen, before we get started to talk about what has been happening on the campus, mm-hmm. your activities there, I want you to give our listening audience a little synopsis of you. I'm quite sure that you didn't get in that, and I might be wrong, but that's why I want you to kind of explain it to myself, Brother Richard, and to the listening audience. I'm quite sure that you didn't just get on a college campus and say, wow, what's going on with our students here? We're being disrespected. I'm going to do something about it. Did you come from an activist family? Did your mom and dad or your mom or your dad kind of raise you up in being active and knowing what's going on? Or did you just develop this on the campus?
Yeah, so my parents had a heavy influence upon my identity as a black man and my growth as a black man, making sure that I was always conscious of my identity and how that plays into the interactions that I have with the world.
Wow.
And they gave me the room, the space to figure out what I wanted to do with that energy and with that knowledge. And so whether that manifested as an activist, whether that manifested as an intellectual who would eventually invest in the community, or whether it was both of those, they gave me the room to do so. And so throughout my younger days, middle school, high school, leading up to community college and being at UCLA, I always had individual professors. I had black professors. I had black counselors. I had black mentors that went out of their way to ensure that I was succeeding and I was knowledgeable of the impact that the community had in that success. And so all of that combined made me feel that there was nothing less that I could do than to serve my community as an advocate and as a servant through my high school days, through my community college days, and now at UCLA.
Listen, before we get into the conversation of what's going on in the campus, Brother Isaiah, I want to thank you as a young man out here fighting. You know that this is something that some of the adults don't do. Richard, and I know that you'll agree with me on this. The spirit that he has, that was cultivated in him by his parents, to get out here, and if he see things going wrong, to fight it. He got the utmost respect from me.
Same here. Same here.
Thank you. I really appreciate it. And thank you for giving me a platform to hopefully mobilize a bunch of other young adults and older adults as well to help you do the same thing. It's all about serving, not necessarily the acknowledgement. So, but I definitely appreciate it, for sure.
You know, I pulled up a list of the demands, too, and I want to go into a few of those. But I want you to give our listening audience a synopsis of what has been going on the campus, of some of the areas that has been totally disrespectful to the black student body there, and what kind of caused this, because I understand that you and the rest of the organization went in and disrupted one of the basketball games there. Tell us a little bit about what has happened leading up to what you did.
Yeah, so essentially it's been a fight that's continued on for decades, and I'm simply carrying it on. It really began with the inception of the African Student Union, but in recent past, you can point to the passage of Prop 209 in California, which stopped affirmative action from still taking place in California. And so that severely impacted the enrollment rates of African American students at UCLA. So in 2006, we saw that there's only 96 enrolled and admitted black students out of a population that was closer to on the higher end of 30,000, 40,000 students. And so.
Wait a minute, Isaiah. Hold on a second. I don't mean to cut you, because I kind of figured that UCLA had a large student body. You said of about 30,000 students, it was 96 blacks enrolled.
So it was 96 black students that were admitted and then enrolled that year out of an incoming class of closer to 5,000-6,000.
Okay.
Probably north of those numbers even.
Okay. Go ahead.
Yeah. So, and then you'll see even later on in 2013 where there was there was 30 black students in UCLA's law school enrolled at the time out of the larger numbers of students that are in the law school as well. And then there have been obviously issues of racial discrimination and prejudice that have been happening over the course of the past couple of years in terms of the blackface party that was thrown by a fraternity on UCLA, a fraternity and a sorority on UCLA's campus in 2016. And that began the list of demands that I helped to further actualize during the course of this year. And there have been other smaller instances and obviously microaggressions and neglect of the black community in terms of its prioritization for campus climate and for actual instrumental change on this campus and the wellness of black students on this campus, because the retention rates are, I think the last time we checked, it was closer to 80% retention rates, when obviously we need closer to 100% of our black students graduating. And so all of this contributed to what we see now in terms of the protests that we had at the basketball game. And in addition to this, UCLA is one of the very, very, very few UCs. I think it's UCLA and one of the UC that doesn't have a Black Resource Center. And so although it does have other entities that are attempting to service the Black community amongst all other communities on this campus, it continues to neglect the need for specific resources for its Black community and its Black students, graduate, undergraduate, Black faculty and Black staff.
Richard, go ahead.
You know, Brother Isaiah, what interests me is the formation of this this body, the student body, the political body. So let me, so you're the president of the student union, student council?
Yes, sir. So my official position is the chairperson of the African Student Union.
And is that a position that is that you had to run for, and is that something you want to do every year, a person every year, or?
Yeah, so I did have to run, and the position, there's a re-election every single year, so we're actually currently in our election season, and guys, unless you're graduating, you can also continue on the year, but I'll be graduating this spring, so I won't be chairperson next year, but yeah.
And I'm trying to help us understand the political process, right? That you had to go through and provide this leadership, but also the this assembly of members at this point are bringing forth this. So, how large is the Black Student Union membership at this point? Mm-hmm.
We don't have. Officially, our membership is comprised of all students, faculty, and staff who consider themselves of the African diaspora. So if we talk about numbers on this campus, then there's closer to 3,000 or so students, somewhere between 4 and 5% of UCLA's population is Black. And so that would be considered our membership. However, there are a much smaller amount of students that are actively contributing and participating in the African Student Union. I would say it's closer to probably 300 or so.
That's active members. Okay. Great, Richard. I'm sorry.
Yeah, because and the other thing is we're laying out this before we get into the question about, you know, just what the demands is, because I'm interested in how y'all got to this point. You know, and you're being there. So the UCLA administration body that you're presenting your demands for, does it have a large, and I'm gonna call it bureaucracy, large Black bureaucracy presence, or is that also a small Black bureaucracy presence as far as the persons who are actually in administrative leadership and decision making positions that are of African descent?
So I would say it is definitely on a smaller side. There are obviously a much larger amount of white men that are in those positions. However, our vice chancellor of student affairs is an African-American male, and so is our vice provost of enrollment management, Yolanda Copeland Morgan, who was hired a couple of years ago as well, and vice chancellor of student affairs was hired or came into his position a year ago.
Mm-hmm. And so now the momentum, the political momentum to get to the point where you're at now, is this something, as you said, this is something that an institution, is the university itself, has been over some years, the political momentum position you right now, is this something that just been happening over the last couple of years, in the last year, or have this something been that has been transitioned to you as the new leadership?
Yeah, so I think it's a combination of both. I think it's been, the fight has been definitely something that's continued on over the course of a couple of decades, from the inception of Proposition 209. And so I think from the late 90s, I can point to several occurrences in terms of the Days of Defiance, in which we protested against Chancellor Carnesal, who was an active proponent of Prop 209. And I can point to other instances in which the African Student Union has done several protests that contributed to the turmoil or the not necessarily amicable campus climate that we see today. And obviously, over the course of the past couple of years, that tension has built with the Black Faith Party and with the interactions with student government being intensified as well and not necessarily amicable. And so during my experience as African Student Union chairperson, that has obviously heightened due to the continued stagnancy of the administration and continued stagnancy of the university to acknowledge the efforts of my predecessors.
So that's, that's, and that's like important for us to understand the politics of this process. So, the other question as far as your leadership in this here process right now, what lessons that you can share with us that you see is something that, as far as leadership strategies that you can share with us that you have actually learned as you've moved to this point of presenting, these positions to the administration, under your leadership? What lessons, personal lessons you're noticing about politics and the interrelationship of being able to create demands to a power structure?
So this is all from my perspective and my experience. I've seen that there's one important lesson. There's a couple important lessons that I can touch upon. To begin, I think that regardless of how high you get or the spaces that you're in, you need to make sure that your feet are still touching the ground. And you need to make sure that you're still connected to the community from which you came, or else everything that you fought for, everything that you're, all the people that you're trying to advocate for, will lose faith in you, and you'll then be fighting for the wrong things. So if you're fighting for the community and you're not in touch with the community, what are you fighting for? And so ensuring and maintaining that constant connection with the community that you're fighting for is imperative. In addition to this, understanding that being in those higher spaces, you have to transfer information and be the liaison between the information that's not necessarily accessible to everyone, and facilitating that so that what may not be common knowledge now becomes common knowledge, and thus makes a common effort to create the change that you're trying to see. And then lastly, I would say that regardless of if you get the opportunity to be in conversation and be amidst those who wield power, as I do, to meet with the chancellor of the university, meet with the vice chancellor of student affairs, and Vice President of Enrollment Management, and Administrative Vice Chancellor, all these high individuals within the university structure, it's important to realize that although you have to work and consistently advocate for the community, it doesn't mean that individuals are always attempting to inhibit you. So there's obviously that stigma that administration is always against the students and is always trying to advocate against what we're fighting for. However, you need to find the heroes who may not be as loud. So you're not necessarily always working with the person who's on top of the chain of command, but rather maybe working with some of his lessers in order to accomplish the same goals, because they're the ones who may be a continual advocate for you despite the counter arguments or counter attacks on the side of the much larger individuals or entities.
And I apologize in advance for speaking as if you're not there, but Elliot what he just laid out is so powerful in the sense of what we talk about in relationship to the qualities and the understanding that a leader dealing with, you know, leading folks in relationship to trying to accomplish demands should have, right? And the thing that struck me, all three of them, and that you articulated, you know, Brother Isaiah, because you articulated them so fluently, it means that your development, and again, I'm not being condescending, your development for me is very much on target.
I know.
Because that question about information, which you as a process of making sure you grounding, yes, is important. Being able to recognize that everybody isn't against you is important. But what we find is that a lot of times, as you know, we talk about the politics within our community, that one thing that the people who supposed to be in these positions don't do is communicate the information back. They know that we don't know. And you're articulating that that's important and what you are learning. And that's kind of real. I mean, that is really powerful and important, I think, for us to share. And my other question in that is, and you did really mention it, but I just wanted to, you know, bring it out as a term. And as a student and as a quote unquote young man, the intergenerational communication, how do you see, or how has that been important in getting to this point where you and leadership and the bodies that are supporting this effort? How important is that in having that intergenerational communication?
I think it's imperative. It's integral to the very efforts that I'm trying to make. If you look at the demands from this year, from last year, and from the year before that, you can see that there's a continuance of the very fight that I'm fighting today. And that fight has stems from that of those who came before me decades ago. So this is nothing new, and that's because of the relationship that I was able to maintain with the generations that came before me. And so in addition to continuing on the fight, they also invested in me the knowledge to be able to lead in an effective manner and to be able to communicate with an administration that isn't necessarily being proactive about actualizing our bills. And so even prior to my enrollment at UCLA, I was able to be invested in by generations that came before me and much older individuals who were able to give me the knowledge to be able to succeed in this situation now, although I didn't initially understand it. And so all of that has been integral to why I'm able to succeed now and why I'm able to help others to succeed. And why the African Student Union is succeeding in its efforts. So that intergenerational connection is one that can't be lost and must be sustained.
Richard, that's I'm so proud to hear him talk like that, Richard. Especially after some of the conversations we've been having, maybe the past month, to hear from Brother Isaiah, who I assume might be 21, 22 years old. You correct me if I'm wrong, Brother Isaiah.
I'm actually 20 years old.
Okay. To hear from a young man that's 20 years old talking about the importance of continuing a struggle in the respect of the people that have came before him is very important, Richard. Words can't express how proud I am of this young man, and I've never met him. Brother Isaiah, talk about... because I want you to voice the list of demands that the student body put to the school administration, UCLA administration, and for our listening audience, we're speaking to head of the Black Student Union at UCLA, Brother Isaiah Njoku. It was an article that was in the Atlanta Black Star this week about UCLA's African Student Union push a list of demands calling for $40 million to build a Black Resource Center. Brother Isaiah, it was a list of anti-blackness against black students within the undergraduate and graduate and the family housing communities, and you list some examples. One of the first ones that listed here is the 1969 members of the Black Panther Party, Bunchy Carter and John Huggins, were slain at Campbell Hall. And to this day, UCLA has failed to properly honor the deaths by not properly memorializing them. Speak about that, because, Richard, I didn't know that members of the party were killed on UCLA campus. Did you know that, Richard?
Yes.
You did? Okay, go ahead. Okay. Brother Isaiah, speak to that issue and why that was important to the Black Student Union.
Of course. The slaying, the murder of John Huggins and Bessie Carter on our campus have been integral to the African-American experience on our campus, and specifically within the African Student Union over the course of the last 50 years. This year marks the 50th anniversary of their death. And to this day, there is simply a rock that was placed outside the hall in the bushes, a rather large rock that states or that memorializes them, saying John Huggins, Bunchy Carter, and kind of just it signifies their presence on this campus. And that's one of the only things that is in existence that the university has gone out of its way to acknowledge their impact. Furthermore, I think there's a newspaper that's hung along the wall inside the building, however, detailing the actual occurrence and informing those who read of exactly what happened. However, you can walk through that hall and simply not acknowledge the history that exists there. And you can disregard the very impact of John Huggins and Bunchy Carter upon this campus in terms of their building of a foundation of activism on this campus and their building of a cohesive community on this campus. And yearly, people show out and they turn out to their event memorializing their passing, and still the university doesn't acknowledge it in a sufficient manner. That's why we asked this year in our demands that they rename the entire hall to Huggins Carter Hall instead of Campbell Hall.
Okay. Now, the other one, the 2006 Prop 209 passage, you spoke about that. You have another one listed here, UCLA chapters of the Sigma Phi, look like that's Filson fraternity, and the Alpha Psi sorority held Kanye Western parties complete with racial stereotypes, caricatures of black people, and UCLA didn't adequately punish any of the fraternities or sororities involved. Now, this seems to be a trend, a generational trend, with a lot of whites on college campuses. I mean, we've seen it when they uncover some of these governors that 30 years ago, they've been doing the same thing. So we see that this stuff continues generation after generation. Speak about that one, Brother Isaiah.
Yes, sir. So there, as I stated, with a Kanye Western party a couple years back with blackface, with caricatures of the African-American community, which were completely inappropriate, and those fraternities and sororities are still existent on UCLA's campus today. And were not properly reprimanded for the repercussions of their actions, which severely hurt the black community and really displayed how the culture hasn't changed or shifted at all. And so, obviously, we had to respond. There was protests. There was the incipiency of these demands that you see now, or the republicization of these demands that you see now. And so that was the larger catalyst of the fight that you see today in these past couple of years. And so although there was some type of protest and there was some type of response that the African Student Union gave to these events, administration did not do anything sufficiently in order to address this, nor did they work adequately enough with the African Union to affect campus climate on a large enough level and educate the students that are in attendance to the university to perpetuate the changing of the status quo as it relates to equity, diversity, and inclusion on our campus. That's why you see issues within campus housing today, this year, and amongst Black students, Black graduate students, actually, in terms of they're feeling unsafe within their housing experience because you have them being over-policed, you have them being, you have the N-word being yelled loudly at those residents in their place of residence, and UCLA has done little to nothing to educate its student body sufficiently to rectify these issues. So that's a couple things that stemmed from the Kanye Western party.
If I may, Ali, something stimulates out of response to Brother Isaiah. You come from an area where story and images, kind of like the major product, right? As far as media and the whole commercialization of imagery and storytelling coming out of California. The question I have, because, sometimes we see these shows where especially now, they're having these dialogues between, say, the Black Student Union and these other fraternities and sorority. And, what I would like to get from you is kind of realistic picture at UCLA. Is there any dialogue or have been any dialogue, not just the administration and what they do, but between these two bodies in relationship to the effect that they have? Have y'all been into any dialogue or attempted any, or how has the dialogue went, if you have been in?
Mm-hmm. Well, from my experience and knowledge, there hasn't been much of that conversation directly between the African Student Union and these fraternities and sororities because of the fact that we aren't even paid for our jobs, and there's individuals who are paid to hold these fraternities and sororities accountable and paid to inform and educate these fraternities and the individuals who are on our campus on matters of equity, diversity, and inclusion who aren't doing their job. And so rather than take on that extra workload to perhaps create a class or create some type of educational structure to inform these students, we figured that it'd be more productive to employ the individuals whose job it is and who are getting paid for these activities to reach out and educate the fraternities and sororities. That there have been sufficient efforts on our behalf with the individuals who are responsible for fraternities and sororities to educate specifically those individuals who made those infractions in terms of the Kanye Western party. But we're working currently on creating a training that will educate not only those fraternities and sororities, but every student at UCLA on matters of diversity, equity, and inclusion.
Hmm. And is that the people who are responsible for, as you say, to develop that, how has been the relationship as you present the dissatisfaction of their role in educating those fraternities and sororities, or the dissatisfaction that they're not doing? How has that dialogue with that person been with the union, in the African Student Union itself?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So there was actually a changing of the positions. The person that's in the position now was not previously before. However, their predecessor was also a Black man, and they had fairly good relations and were able to bring repercussions or somewhat of repercussions to the fraternities and sororities, and so at least within his ability. And so that was fairly amicable and fairly productive. However, upon the changing of hands of the position and the taking up of the responsibilities to higher powers, we see that there has been less and less productivity as it pertains to those issues, specifically not only with fraternity and sorority life, but the student body in general.
Hmm. Yes, that's interesting.
Brother Isaiah, the one other thing I want to get to before, because Richard asked a question about the response of the administration there at the school, and you were saying the response was kind of slow, which led to the direct action that you did at the basketball game. What was the response after the direct action was taken at the basketball game? Was it immediate response to, well, let's talk, did they take you seriously after that? What happened in regards to the direct action that was taken at the basketball game?
Mm-hmm. So directly after that, I was able to see the Vice Chancellor of Student Affairs in passing, and he had assured me that there would be conversation that would be facilitated afterwards. And we had given them via the press release a deadline for response from administration, basically either assuring or rejecting the demands that we had. And so they sent an email right before the deadline, essentially saying, "We hear you. We're looking forward to further conversation, and we'll let you know at our next meeting what our position is on each of these things." And so there was a meeting with the chancellor that occurred about a week and a half afterwards between the chancellor, the vice chancellor of student affairs, and a plethora of other individuals that are amidst administration. And we were able to have some relative amount of productivity in terms of the conversation that we've had. Obviously, we met some hindrances when it relates to the changing of the name of Campbell Hall and the Black Resource Center, because UCLA is considered one of the smallest UCs. And so space is an issue when it comes to founding a new Black Resource Center. However, there has been the creation of a task force, per se, or a work group that's going to be implementing the diversity training by next year. So that's obviously a win. And then also there's going to be a campaign or work group that's going to be working on the generation of funds for the $20 million endowment, and the university will be making some sort of donation to Abdomina as well, although we don't know numbers just yet. So there was some progress. However, it's taken 2 to 3 years to get that progress to occur.
Okay. One of your listed demands here is the relocation of the African diaspora floor, and in parentheses it has Black student housing. Talk about that, the African diaspora floor. What is that? Just a building where a lot of the Black students are? Mm-hmm. Go ahead. You explain it.
Yeah. So there's currently the African diaspora floor, or considered the African diaspora living learning community, is one floor, or really a half of a floor, where Black students occupy and our house typically is the first year students or second year students that stay there. However, it's not restricted to those years. And so recently, relatively recently, within the past couple of years or so, it's been raised to the African Student Union's attention that the floor is inadequate. It's Reber Hall, which houses the floor, the residential hall, which houses the floor, is considered one of the oldest residential halls on UCLA's campus, and they're currently building new residential halls. They just built new residential halls less than a decade ago. Like, there have been rooms to make accessions to and improve Black student housing opportunity. However, they haven't been taken. And in addition to this, a couple of years ago, last year, there were feces that were placed in the laundry room on the floor, the laundry room on the living learning community floor, which is completely inappropriate and completely disgusting. hence why it only exacerbated the issue and led to the ask to change black student housing, or at least improve it so that it there's improved security and improved comfortability for black students on the residential area for UCLA's campus.
If I may, you know, one thing that UCLA is sometimes in the broader press is kind of projected as a liberal school, you know, a liberal, not that it's liberal arts, but just the environment is of a liberal composure. And what comes to my mind when I hear about the feces, and I think I heard about the, you know, the fear that students have in their residential living. The question I have is that, what has been the response of the white students to this effort that y'all are making in relationship to the demand of the administration? And yes, that's one. And, you know, in this time, in other areas, we hear to talk about allies. Do you see natural allies or negotiated allies coming to the support of the demands by the white students, which is such a large population at UCLA, to what the request that you're asking from the administration?
Mm-hmm. To be honest, we don't have white allies. There have been little to no efforts made by white students on our behalf, aside from the passage of a resolution by student government to support the demand. And that was after pressure from black constituents and black people who are part of student government to get that ratified. And so there have been, like, I would say probably one or two white individuals who aided in the process of trying to actualize these demands. However, on a broader basis, there has been no support from the white community. Allies have been found in the other underrepresented communities, such as Samahang Filipino, which is a group that represents Filipino students on our campus, and then Mecha, which is a group that represents Latinx communities on our campus, and a couple others as well that could be mentioned that serve as allies and are consistently there to advocate alongside us as well. No support from white allies. So, yeah.
Now, Elliot, should we take this as a lesson in the broader political relationships that we are making on particular issues, political issues, as black people, and especially in this political climate, look to push either a black agenda or black issues that we're talking about outside of the university experience, and what Brother Isaiah brings. Should we take that as a microcosm of what we should understand?
Certainly, you have to. Certainly, that we're in this fight ourselves, and it's going to take men and women, similar to Brother Isaiah, that's willing to get out there and fight. Certainly, we have to take this as a look into the crystal ball, so to speak, to what we're dealing with. Hold on a second. Let me deal with that. And I'm sorry about that. Yeah, but certainly we have to look at this as. I'm sorry, Richard. I was trying to turn that down. But you know what? Speaking of the allies, Brother Isaiah. And we're speaking to Isaiah Njoku, head of the Black Student Union at UCLA. And it's in reference to the Atlanta Black Star article that talks about UCLA's African Student Union pushing a list of demands calling for $40 million to build a Black Resource Center on the campus for Black students. Brother Isaiah, in reference to what Richard asked about allies, have anyone or any of the Black students reached out to, because, and I'm just dealing with sports figures, because you know, I have relative infinity for basketball. You have a lot of high powered people that have left that college campus and went on to establish themselves nationwide, that have respectability in sports. and that had a track record. One of them had a track record of being an activist when he was young, which is Kareem Abdul-Jabbar. You have others that was on the campus. I don't know how active they are. They've never showed that they have any activism about them, men like Reggie Miller and others. Have any of these people reached out to the Black Student Union? Because I'm quite sure, now you can correct me if I'm wrong, because you seem to know the history of the school that you have went to. I'm quite sure that Kareem Jabbar was a member of the Black Student Union when he was at UCLA. Am I right, Brother Isaiah?
Yes, sir, he was. He was actually a part of it. Back then it was called Harambe Club, but yes, he was.
Does he reach out to, I'm quite sure he's seen what's going on. He might have been at the game or had some knowledge of what you guys are doing, you men and women are doing. Does he reach out to you? Is there any networking between some of the older alumni, or is the young people there or in this struggle themselves?
So we do have, you know, some support from our alumni. There's actually a UCLA Black Alumni Association that's been pivotal in our fight during this year and in years past. However, although I would have loved to say that I've been reached out to by Mr. Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, I haven't thus yet. Although I have yet to use my full network as it pertains to alumni, because there's an individual who's the president of the Sparks basketball team, or something of a similar magnitude, some role of a similar magnitude, that is the head of the UCLA Alumni Association. And so I will potentially be reaching out to her, and hopefully if God grants it, he might connect me with Kareem Abdul-Jabbar. But I've really just been relying on my community and those in my immediate circle, and thus far it's been enough. But okay, raising that $40 million is going to definitely be a task. So,
right, right. And that's an important to be able to now put together that network, because we see outside in other universities, say the HBCUs, that are having difficulty in raising funds. Recognizing that's important. And I'm hoping, you know, Elliot and Brother Isaiah, that those of the listening audience, especially those who may be in California or those alumni, would hear take this as your request. Because $40 million, though it may be nothing to other communities, for us, obviously, is a challenge, and take this as a request for, you know, not necessarily waiting to get support, but willing to reach out to be supportive in, you know, assisting that building that fund. So I take that, you know, that we should be looking forward to hear, you know, Elliot, to the question that you raised in the future, that we, when Brother Isaiah come, you can tell us that they have been knocking to him or the next administration to be supportive in that kind of fundraising endeavor.
Yeah, hopefully that happens. But definitely be using the network. It's something that you can't do without. Activism is the crux of not activism is network and your community. So I'll definitely be reaching out, and as you said, hopefully when you check back in, I'll have a different story for you.
Brother Isaiah, the because I noticed on some of the problems that that the organization listed, it was talking about racial profiling on the college campus and also in student housing. A lot of the students were harassed or racially profiled. Has it been talked in the organization of the fear of any repercussions on any of the students? Have any of them voiced any repercussions? Because I know that that's a concern for some of the students there. They're, you know, their mothers and fathers are paying for them to go to school, and some of their parents might not be supportive of their actions. They might be torn between their activism and just, you know, their parents sending them to school. So Has there been any repercussions? Have the school come after any of the students for their activism or even yourself?
Oh, not at all. I think that as students, first and foremost, we ensure that we, despite whatever activism that we might want to engage in, that we are engaging in, that our academics come first and that we graduate. Because at the end of the day, we can't be activists on this campus if we're not enrolled and if we're not succeeding in our classrooms.
Okay.
And so that's portrayed in one of the first retention programs in the nation that was started by our African Student Union back in the 80s, called the Academic Supports Program, which provides student peer counselors to ensure that our activists, our student body, is retaining themselves and graduating on a consistent basis. And so if a parent were ever to, or if the school was ever to raise concerns as to our participation in activism, we would point to the fact that we're ensuring a balanced life and ensuring that we are engaging not only in activism, but also in our studies and upholding one another to a standard of not only academic excellence, but excellence within our endeavors of service as well.
Okay.
If I may, one thing that you mentioned in as far as your studies, as far as like social science and public health, are you going to continue on what is your plan in relationship to your academic pursuit? Is this mm-hmm. another step or?
Yeah, so this is obviously one step of advocacy. I hope to continue to advocate for the rest of my life and to serve for the rest of my life. And I plan on doing so via getting a master's in nursing and going into the nursing field and eventually establishing my own clinic in an underrepresented community so as to provide life and to provide health to the Black community, because what will we have without our life? How will we advocate if we can't make it through the day? Who will we be able to serve if we can't get up out of bed because of the health ailments that the government is continually trying to produce within our community? That's my plan and my goal, and hopefully that will provide life for the next activist, the next advocate, the next servant. So, yeah.
Oh, great. I'm glad to hear that.
Isaiah, one question before I let you go, and I want you to keep in touch with me, man. Send me an email if you want to come back on and give us an update on what's going on. You have my contact, and I want you to feel free to use it. In fact, I want to talk with you because if you want some time, maybe for the Black Student Union there, if you're in touch with other Black Student Unions to have some type of air time where you can voice these things, we'll talk. Okay?
For sure. Thank you.
One other thing before you leave us. I noticed from your name, tell us, are your parents from this, from here, or are they from the continent?
Yeah, so my grandfather immigrated from Nigeria, actually.
Okay, now, a question. I'm just curious. It's called the African Student Union, but you're not delineating from Africans from the continent or Africans in the diaspora. You're all involved in the African Student Union. Am I right?
That is correct.
Okay, all right. I just wanted to, you know, I wanted to hear from another generation whether this fight that's going on, and I'm quite sure you hear about it, what you feel in reference to it, the global struggle for mm-hmm. reparations for our ancestors and people trying to put themselves in brackets. I'm from here. I'm from the islands. I'm from the continent. I'm from the United States. We're different. What do you feel in reference to that, Brother Isaiah? Just give me a little help with this.
Yeah, no, I think that the people who changed the African Student Union name, or the Black Student Union name, to the African Student Union name had a purpose, had a reasoning. And that reasoning was that despite how far spread, how widespread our community has become due to colonialism, due to imperialism, due to the effects of the European efforts to dismantle our communities, we need to realize that at the end of the day, we come from the same place. Us as members of the African diaspora have a common incipiency. We have a common goal. We have a common drive and energy within our heart to be no longer oppressed and to be liberated from the chains which binded our ancestors and which are continually restricting us on a contemporary basis. And so the only way to free ourselves is by eliminating those walls and those barriers that are segregating, that are dividing our communities. And so the way to do that, first and foremost, is verbally, by acknowledging the fact that I'm African, others are African, and although you may not look black, if you are of the African diaspora, then we got to be fighting for the same thing, which is the liberation of the African peoples.
There you go. That's what I'm talking about.
Brother Isaiah, I want to thank you for being with us, man. Remember what I said. Reach out to me. If you don't reach out to me soon, I'm going to reach back out to you.
Sounds good.
Okay.
Thank you for having me.
Okay. Great, man. We'll talk soon.
All right. Take care.
Peace. We're going to take a brief break, Richard. When we come back, Freestyle Friday will be in effect. Anything that's on your mind, you can give us a call, 215-490-9832. That's 215-490-9832. Time for Awakening. We'll be right back.
Listening to Time for an Awakening, Time for an Awakening, with host Brother Elliot and Brother Richard on Time for an Awakening Media, part of the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasting or live program scheduling, hit them up at timeforanawakening@gmail.com.
All Insurance Incorporated, an African American owned and operated insurance agency and business for over 20 years, located at 231 Southeastern Road in Glenside, PA, with other offices in Germantown and West Philadelphia. Call now for commercial insurance quotes, homeowners insurance quotes, automobile insurance quotes, notary and tax services, representing over 15 major A-rated insurance companies, offering a discount on all notary services when you call in for a free quote. Call this number, 215-885-2444. That number is 215-885-2444. 215-885-2444. All Insurance Incorporated.
Before your roof becomes unruly, call Dooley. Dooley Brothers, specializing in shingle, rubber roofs, gutters, downspouts, and vinyl sidings. Call for your free estimate today. 215-224-3882. That's 215-224-3882. Dooley Brothers Roofing, the roofing experts you can trust. That number again, 215-224-3882. 215-224-3882. Before your roof becomes unruly, call Dooley.
I think you'll find, sir, that there will come a time when black people wake up and become intellectually independent enough to think for themselves. As other humans are intellectually independent enough to think for themselves, then the black man will think like a black man, and he will feel for other black people. And this new thinking and feeling will cause black people to stick together. And then at that point, you'll have a situation where when you attack one black man, you are attacking all black men. And this type of black thinking will cause all black people to stick together. And this type of thinking also will bring an end to the brutality inflicted upon black people by white people. And it is the only thing that will bring an end to it. No federal court, state court, or city court will bring an end to it. It's something that the black man has to bring an end to himself.
And leaders, you administrators, you teachers, you leaders, you are the worst. No cowardly, punctified leader will lead this new generation of young black men and women. Your day of leading them is finished. Young people, you can't feel that you're missing them. Parents, you can't feel when you're talking to your children that this is a new generation and they don't want to hear your compromising talk. Did you hear them in Ferguson tell Jesse, get the hell out of here? You ain't no leader. I was hurting for my brother because Jesse worked hard for our people. But time has moved on. And what was good yesterday ain't no good at all today. So either you become a new vessel so that new wine can be poured into the old wine. Your day of leading our people is over, and it will never come back to you again.
Damn it, we're still in the land of our bondage. We're still in the land of captivity. We're still a slave to the Democratic Party. Still a slave to the Republican Party. You can't even see a Freedom Party. You don't see it. You're a slave. I'm a slave. And unless we admit that we are slaves, then we can never get free. Never get free.
Who put the present Democratic administration in Washington, D.C. The whites were evenly divided. It was the fact that you threw 80% of your votes behind the Democrats that put the Democrats in the White House. When you see this, you can see that the Negro vote is the key factor. And despite the fact that you are in a position to be the determining factor, what do you get out of it? The Democrats have been in Washington, D.C. only because of the Negro vote. They've been down there 4 years, and they're all other legislation they wanted to bring up, they brought it up and gotten it out of the way, and now they bring up you. And now they bring up you. You put them first, and they put you last, because you're a chump. A political chump.
So you could see that the government of America has been planning our demise. Any members of Congress here, any members of the civil rights movement that are here, you love this nation. You've suffered every indignity to make America better, that she might be great. And every time you forced her to make a law that was in our favor, they came right behind that law with skill and chicanery to make the law of non-effect. When it came to treating the citizens of African descent fairly, America failed. She put them in chains. The government put them on slave quarters, put them on auction blocks, put them in cotton fields, put them in inferior schools, put them in substandard housing, put them in scientific experiments, put them in the lowest paying jobs, put them outside the equal protection of the law, kept them out of their racist bastions of higher education, and locked them into positions of hopelessness and helplessness. The government gives them the drugs, builds bigger prisons, passes a three-strike law, and then wants us to sing God Bless America? No, no, no. Not God Bless America. God damn America. That's in the Bible for killing innocent people. God damn America for treating her citizens as less than human. God damn America, as long as she tries to act like she is God and she is supreme.
Welcome back to Time for an Awakening. Again, I want to thank Isaiah Njoku, who was with us to talk about the struggles of the African Student Union there on UCLA's campus and the things that they're doing, the direct action that they're doing to get the demands met. Brother Richard.
Yes, sir.
It was refreshing to hear from Brother Isaiah. This young man's 20 years old, Richard.
Hmm.
And some of the things he was saying, oh man, it was great. It was great hearing from him.
Yeah, it's you know, Elliot, you know, and he sparked the association in my mind as the young sister we got from Northeast.
You know what? I wanted to try to get in contact with her so she can listen to the program this evening, but I'll send her a podcast because I want to get her back on. You know, just to kind of continue some of the dialogue that we had with her a while ago.
You know, just that the ideal of being, what I would say is being clear of what is in front of them. Now, we know, you know, all of us know as we go through time, there's going to be other obstacles. But at that age, at 20, and, you know, being, I mean, when he laid out those 3 points of what he learned, you couldn't, I don't think you can get a seasoned politician, bureaucrat, or one who's in one of these here institutional leadership to be so succinct and so clear about their responsibility as a leader to the community that they serve. and the challenge, because it's not just having the responsibility to be able to communicate, but the challenge of what you're dealing with and being able to be honest about that challenge, that you're not to go and think everybody's your enemy on one hand, and that it is a negotiating process. I don't hear that out of seasoned politicians. They, and when they say it, they make it seem like it's so insulting in the way they communicate, like you don't understand that we live in a system that wasn't set up for us, and that what you're sent there to do is to fight, but negotiate, and not to expect that there, things is just going to be handed to you because you're there. But we also don't expect you to do the same thing people have been doing, and most importantly, neglecting the community that you're supposed to serve. And that's, you know, it's still to be seen, but it is refreshing to hear, you know, a young man, 20 years old, with only a year in the leadership position, being able to articulate that.
And he kept mentioning about reflecting back on the trials and tribulations and building upon the work that was done by people before him, and that, how much he respected that. Those are tremendous qualities, man. That's why I asked him, Richard, about his background. I wanted him to talk about, you know, his activism, where just whether it just developed on that college campus or where it came from, and he expressed where it came from. His parents, and also
and some individuals there in that institution that can provide that what we call now mentorship, or some say JETA relationship. It is as that clip you play, Farrakhan saying, "Can't you hear them? Hear what they're saying."
Well, I intend for the listening audience to be hearing from him in the future, and hopefully him networking with some of these other black student unions. In fact, I got a message there from Professor Ezra Alarone that wrote the three books on sovereignty, that the black student union there is planning something for next week. I'll try to read that today. I know I'm going to read it by Sunday. That they're having there at the that they're having at Delaware State University on April 10th to the 12th, which is that's next weekend, Richard, I think. And we'll have them on to talk about that, and hopefully we can get either him or maybe one of the Black Student Union or one of their speakers to come on and share with us, because the featured speaker, according to the information that he sent me, will be Samia Nkrumah, who's Kwame Nkrumah's daughter, and she'll be here to address the Black Student Union there at Delaware State. So it's important, Richard, that on these college campuses, whether you're talking about HBCUs or some of these other campuses, that you have a cadre of our students there that are there for a purpose. Just like Brother Isaiah said, he's there to get his degree. But that activism and fighting for his people is in him. And he said he intends to do it until he dies, the day he dies. So all hope is not lost. It's not a gloomy picture as far as I'm concerned. Our young people out there fighting and preparing to fight and looking at this as a global struggle. You heard him say it.
And I really, you know, emphasizing that point, that because I hear this going on, and I just want to emphasize it now. The question is the relationship to young leadership or young individuals who recognize the importance of doing, you know, doing, building, doing the work, that it isn't just for them to reach out to us, especially when, you know, you hear me always raise this point about intergenerational. It isn't important just for us to reach out to us. And you raised it with the question about Brother Kareem Abdul-Jabbar. It's important for us to recognize, hear, see, feel that there's individuals out there, and then reach out to them to ask them, how can we be of some support?
Yeah, that's one reason why I brought that up, because, well, when he was there, he was Alcindor. He changed his name when he got to the pros, but he was still active then. The young man said that he was part of the Emoja House. Didn't he say that?
Yes.
So he was aware of his activities on that campus almost 50 years ago. So, you know, him being a part of that Black Student Union when he was there and still living in Los Angeles or out there on the West Coast, or Hollywood or wherever he lives, and not reaching out to them, they have to look in the mirror in relation to that, because that's not going to stop some of them young people on the campus, Brother Isaiah and the others that are fighting. That those
in
men,
the condition they're fighting against.
Exactly.
Look, what he's saying is that they have these white students, not only, as you mentioned, are continuing a tradition that we've seen governors, people who are in high places that would when they were young.
Yeah. Yeah.
And the kind of dialogue that they have either accepted or been exposed to as they matured and getting into positions of power, reinforcing something that they're having this go on now, but they're not reaching out to them. Those white liberals, those, you know, and that does say something.
Mm-hmm.
That does say something. And we do have no one to look out for us but us. You know, good, bad, or indifferent. And we have to work through that, you know, creating those alliances, those relationships. Because obviously, and look at the number he was saying, the amount of students on that campus, and you only get one or two who say, oh, I see what you're doing, and it is just, and I'll provide some support. And we go back 50 years, they'll, you know, you'll see the news clips. They used to call them newsreels, right? In the 20s and 30s, but, you know, 30s and 40s. But the news clips of what was going on in the 60s and how supposedly white liberals were dealing with, as they were dealing with the Vietnam War and the kind of, or support for the Panthers. But this is 2019. And look, are their demands unjust? And then you still have individuals that are putting feces in their, you know, washing area, mm-hmm. or actually, you know, they feel threatened in their residency place. You know, these kind of people are going there to these kind of institutions. So it's important for us to be in this dialogue with them. I guess that's the point that we're making.
Yeah. Richard, before we because we got a call or two sitting online, April 4th, 51 years ago, King was assassinated, Martin Luther King was assassinated in Memphis. Question is, Richard, and this is a critical question, just a rhetorical question. What have we learned in reference to King being assassinated? What lessons or what safeguards did we enact as conscious people or conscious groups to protect ourselves from what happened to Dr. King? Now, I want to play this clip because I'm dealing with something specific when I'm asking this question. You might know where I'm going, Richard, and then you might not. But I just want to play this clip, and then I'll ask that question again. Have we learned anything, or did we develop another strategy? Because the powers that be are using the same strategy, and they plan to. You can see it clearly. But let me play this clip to kind of preface my question. If I can get this information up, I'll do it. Let's go here.
Finally tonight, a famed civil rights photographer who appears to have also done duty, double duty, for the FBI. Margaret Warner has the story.
A freelance photographer for the black press in the 1950s and 1960s, Ernest Withers chronicled landmark moments in the battle for civil rights. He covered the 1955 murder of Emmett Till, the bus boycotts, and protests like the 1968 sanitation worker strike in Memphis. He was treated like an insider and given intimate access to movement leaders like Dr. Martin Luther King. But this week, the Memphis Commercial Appeal reported that Withers also worked as an FBI informant, most probably paid, from at least 1968 through 1970. For more, we turn to Earl Caldwell. He reported on the civil rights struggle for the New York Times and knew Withers. He's now a professor at Hampton University's Scripps Howard School of Journalism. And Mr. Caldwell, welcome. Give us first a sense of Ernest Withers and how important his work was to this country's understanding of the civil rights movement.
His work was hugely important because he brought back the pictures. You know, you can have 1,000 words, but it's the pictures. And he had access. He was on the inside. So he was able to show America things that you couldn't tell America. But he had those pictures. He had so many, and he cataloged everything. So I think his work was hugely important.
Now, you said yesterday that you were stunned when you heard the news of what the Commercial Appeal was reporting. Why was that? I mean, was it hard to reconcile that with the man you knew?
Well, because he was a journalist, and the black journalist had made this commitment to the black community that we weren't going to be spies, we weren't going to be eavesdropping for law enforcement, that we were going to be true to what we said. And I was taken aback because he had, his record comes out that he was not only doing it in such a massive way.
Did he ever say anything to you that indicated that this might have been going on?
Actually, in our conversations, it was exactly the opposite. We were like, in this together. We were colleagues. I had no idea, although I was very much aware that the pressure was to be an informant has been, it was very intense, particularly about on people such as Ernest, who was moving through all of these various channels and had this tremendous access.
So when you say pressure, what do you mean? Pressure from the FBI?
Pressure from the FBI. In my own case, the FBI hounded me about being an informant on the Black Panthers, which was the subject of my reporting at that time for the New York Times.
And how would they go about it?
Well, they call you on the phone, and they start off by saying, listen, all we want you to do is just, you know, what people are saying, what they make it seem like it's so innocent, like it's really nothing, that you're not really spying, you're just helping us out, and that they are trying to, that they're on your side, and it's make it very engaging. And if you don't have that line there that says, no, that's not what I do, you can get roped in.
Now, the records that the newspaper got a hold of show nothing about his motives whatsoever. There is something in the articles about he was under some financial pressure. He'd also been a cop in the past. Was the FBI good at honing in on any potential point of vulnerability like that?
This is the thing. They wanted everything. So they were always asking everybody, you can do this. And they made it like it was an act of patriotism. You're serving your country. We need you. And it's so harmless. You can do this. And also, as you say, Ernest did have that background piece of being a police officer.
Now, put on your journalist professor's hat. And if you are talking to young people about this, how would you want them to look at it? I mean, is this a betrayal of his ethics as a journalist? Is it a betrayal as an African-American who actually embraced the goals of the civil rights movement?
I believe it's all of those things. But let me speak as a journalist. To me, this is a very serious and special trust. It's a bond that you make with the public. People have to believe you. They have to believe that you are who you say that you are, and that's your only purpose is in serving the public. We as journalists, we say we represent the public. You can't represent the police department and the all of these investigative agencies at the same time. You're either one or you're the other. And the sad part of this thing with Ernest is a lot of reporters now will suffer because when they go and present their credentials, people will say, how do we know?
And yet in Memphis next month, there's going to be a museum open, the Ernest Withers Museum, with a lot of his photographs, right? Yeah. In his old studio on Beale Street. Do you think that in the end you will be able to separate the man from the work and that the work will endure?
The work will endure because the people are, they have this, people understand. And they made this trust with Ernest. And they allowed him to come in to all of these places and to do this great work that he did. The work will endure. But there will be another side. And that is this, that people will say to this next generation, they see people coming in, how can we trust you? How do we know? How can we be sure? How do we know that you're not another Ernest Withers?
Earl Caldwell, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Richard. Richard.
I hear you.
Now that's what I'm talking about. What do you think that we've done anything since King's death? And I'm just using that as a barometer or landmark to address this problem.
You know,
the problem of the Ernest Withers, and I'm using that as a name for any of them that do this. When I say an Ernest Withers, this problem of what he did, because like the clip says, he was a journalist. He had access to all these men, and the stuff he was doing led to people being killed, along with King and others, because he was involved in other different, just like the professor from Hampton said, he moved around to different groups. Now, that professor from Hampton said his focus was on the Panthers, and he was hounded by the FBI to be an informant or snitch for them. Come out that Withers was and was paid to do it, to the point where there's another clip where his daughters and them were totally embarrassed and shocked that their father had done this. What do you think? Has there been any progress to stem this tide, to stem people from doing this? Is it a way that we can detect these people in organizations? You know, I asked that question of Fred Hampton Jr., if you remember when he was on. Mm-hmm. And he said the way they do it is they work continuously all the time. Right. And if you're really not about the work, you'll be exposed, which was one of the best answers I've heard, period. But go ahead.
But in this case, he was working. His role was taking photographs. He was doing that.
Yeah.
And, you know what I mean? So there is, you know, and implicit to me in the question that you're asked, the short answer is for me, no.
Okay.
And I see two sides of it, right? I mean, it's the being able to identify the individuals that may be intelligence gatherers, and being on the other side, being intelligence gatherers, having the infrastructure to be intelligence gatherers. Now, there may be organizations, you know, within our community, in the mobilization that have that mechanism that we're not aware of. But when we talk about the FBI or Homeland Security or State Department or CIA or any of these here, we're aware that these institutions exist. Therefore, those people exist. And their role is to identify, as I think in the language of statecraft, you know, to find not just informants, but people that they can rely on, right? So, I mean, we're aware of it. But for us, it makes me say no. We're not aware that we have those kind of institutions where individuals' responsibility is to identify or role is to go out and gather information, you know, about those we say is against us, and that we becomes the nebulous, right, part. And that's why I say no. So I don't think 50 years later we're any more, not saying, I'm just saying I don't see it. That's not saying it don't exist.
Yeah, I just wanted to see your feelings on that, because I'm in agreement with you, your assessment that you've come up with. But I just want to see what you thought about that. Let's go to 646.
Yeah, what's going on, Richard and Elliot?
How are you, sir? Yes,
sir. Hey, Richard, I got a question for you.
Uh-oh. Already, Elliot. You didn't even get on 10 seconds.
No, I'm not going to talk about the daddy or anything, how he treated you this week. I know the daddy didn't treat you good. I just got a question for you, because I figured you may be able to answer the question. And, you know, I was talking about it a little bit earlier today. I thought you heard it. Maybe Elliot did. But I want to ask you this, Richard. What is the purpose of the fight of black people in regards to white supremacy?
What is the purpose?
Yeah, what is the purpose?
We take the the unresolved project is freedom. I think that's in the historical initiation for those in North America specifically. You know, now how we define freedom over time, and this, you know, the kind of successes of freedom. I think that vision, freedom is a vision. And as the young brother who was just on from UCLA, for me, you know, when I add another layer to that, is the liberation of African people.
No, Jay, let me say something in reference to that, if you don't mind, because I want to add a little something to that. Now, Richard, you said freedom, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Now, Jay is bringing this up. Let me throw this in, Jay. I think that a percentage of our people, and I dare say a large percentage, view the fight against, would you say, white supremacy?
Yeah.
As a struggle for equality.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, I think that whole idea of a struggle for equality with white folks is convoluted at best. Our struggle should not be to be equal with white people. To me, that's so silly. I mean, why would we be struggling to be equal with somebody or another species or race of people that learn from us? That shouldn't be our struggle, to be equal with white folks. Our struggle should be about freedom, just like you said, Richard. But I think that a lot of our people misconstrued that freedom as struggling to be for equality with white folks. That's why they're so excited when this person becomes the first person to do this, the first person to do that, after almost 500 years of us being here in this country with white folks. So, you know, I'm just throwing that in. I don't know where you was necessarily going with that, Jay, but that's – go ahead.
Well, basically, I am at the point to where as I ain't going to deal with white supremacy no more. The hell with it. I want sovereignty. I want African sovereignty. The hell with white supremacy. Because, unfortunately, in the minds of our people – white supremacy really boils nothing down to white people treating them better and white people giving them something.
Okay.
They don't even have a vision or understanding of what sovereignty is. They don't have a vision or understanding what liberation is for people. They don't even have an understanding of basic human rights for people. They're just looking to be in a position of, as one would call, integration and acceptance by white folks.
Mm-hmm.
If you notice, we are at the point now to where as our so-called leadership is now trying to push this whole agenda in regards to these clowns, you know what I mean, that were at the fool's house this week, entertaining him with his nonsense like he's the gatekeeper, Herb Betty. And then you have a situation where you could take it to even a next level, talking about, well, the census is coming up. So everything that we're doing is geared upon integrating into the madness of our oppressor. We're not thinking about or doing anything that's trying to separate ourselves for our own liberation. It could be here or it could be back home. Every other ethnic group in this country is dealing on the basis of sovereignty. What do? They come here to make a better life for themselves and their families in the hope of building up their community here or going back home. We're the only people here, and this is why we don't have anything. Because we're the only ones who, once we gain a level of success or so-called acceptance, we run to get closer to these savages. We never think about building up our own community. We never think about doing the necessary things to move forward as a people, in a sense, independent of this dog. And it's just like, you know, we're caught up in this quagmire of being the only people, it seems to me, that constantly wants to be accepted by white folks. I don't see the Chinese trying to be accepted by them. I don't see the Indians or any other racial group really trying to be accepted by them. I think what they're trying to do is just go about the business at hand. But us, everything is predicated on us being accepted by this character. We go to school and get in massive debts and hope that he gives us a job. We become successful and go and live around him. We never think about or we never do the necessary thing to uplift ourselves and build community. But see, what's happened is we're being manipulated into being defined by a word, and that word is white supremacy. Well, what we really need to be looking at and understanding and developing and growing towards is African sovereignty. It's always something that's kind of got in store for us, and we never seem to figure out what it is and how he's doing it to us because we never define the terms of the argument. This is why we at this position we're in right now of always talking about white supremacy and what white supremacy is doing. But you ask anybody to talk about African sovereignty, and the Negroes will look at you like you crazy.
Well, Jay, if I see myself as a American or striving to be a good American, then I can never see what you're talking about. Because
well,
I don't.
That's because you don't know what you are.
Well, okay.
Since the grave has never been taught that you are a descendant of African people. See, the thing is, if I tell my children from the time they're born that they're Americans and that they don't come from any other place but America, and the reason why they are Americans, then they have nothing to identify with. You see what I'm saying?
Oh, I understand.
That's not my fault on a certain level. That's society's fault. It becomes my fault when I don't educate myself to be able to articulate that to my children. That's what the problem is. And then the thing that makes it even more frustrating is these damn bastards don't even want your black ass. There's no real use for you. That's why you have all these other ethnic groups coming in and superseding us and basically any and everything. That's why you have all these other ethnic groups having communities, neighborhoods, businesses, and all of that. We're the only people in this country, who can't go into another community and prosper. But every damn body else could come into our community and prosper and feed off of us. And you don't think that that's a sickness within the people? How do you accept that? I can't accept that. But see, everybody wants to get on you, your behind, and everybody want to talk about you, and everybody want to say, oh, you're racist, you're negative, you this and that. Whenever you start talking about, why should I give any of these bastards a dime of my money? I can't go into their community and open up a shop. You know what I mean? I mean, it's deep. But we don't think like that, because when your child is born and you have a child and the first thing you identify with them is, well, I'm American. And you never in their lives sit down and tell them that I come from an African people. This is your history. This is your culture. This is the direction that you should be going as a human being. Then what do you expect? And what happens to you in the process? You wanted to be American. If you don't do certain things, what do? They enslave you. As Scottie Reed always talks about, the 13th Amendment. They put you in jail, or if not, they kill you. And then on top of that, they didn't find people and make narratives about them like this brother Nipsey Hussle. The whole narrative for this brother is just, to me, kind of, how would I say, conflicting. That would be the word, conflicting. Because the thing is, there's some good parts of him, there's some bad parts of him, but he really needs to be dissected as a human being and what he really had to offer in regards to our people. Now, did our people really break him down and explain to him who and what he really was? And what examples should we take from him? I don't know. But, you know, I was talking to Mondo about him. I'm impressed with him on some levels, and I'm impressed with him on, and I'm not impressed on him on other levels. But you know what the thing that impressed me the most about him and all that he did is? He went to where his people originated from, and he learned and he gathered appreciation for its culture. And once he gathered appreciation for its culture, it took him into a whole another stratosphere of his development on who he was. And I honestly say, he may have done much more greater things, because in the direction that he was going in, hey man, I respect it. You know what I mean? I respect it. Now, is he still doing some negative cultural things? I don't really know. But to see the way that he was taken away from the planet, one would think he had a little bit of his toe in that sector of negativity. That his whole foot, I don't think so, but a little bit of his toe. But you know, that shows the culture of it. That shows the sickness of it. But you know what the funniest thing about all of it is? That bastard Christopher Dutton is now representing the brother that they say killed him. That's the kind of sick, twisted tragedy of it. That's what's kind of wild to me when you think about it.
The question I have on that, but is that lawyer working pro bono, or is he getting paid?
I think he may be working. I wouldn't say pro bono. I think he's working in a sense that he does cases for the state in regards to they pay him. So it's like it's like you you get certain cases and they pay you. I think they pay you a little bit more than scale or something like that. You know what I mean? It's called Part B or something, I think, in New York State, something like that. Because I had a brother-in-law that's a lawyer that does some of those cases where they're assigned it to you or something like that. But it's kind of funny that God and the wrong people would even get involved in a case like that, man. And to see the whole, because I've looked at a couple of interviews that the brother did, and he was really, really kind of an interesting cat. You know what I mean? He had a vision. He had an idea of certain things. He had a mentality that was caught up in the street, but a little bit outside of the streets in a sense that wasn't really fine-tuned, but was extremely intelligent. Intelligent cat. You know what I mean? He's one of those cats that he was able to hang around as I refer to the muckety mucks and not really get to run over because he has basic common sense. It's like, you know, it's like he could be in a room with someone that's Yale, Harvard, as they say, the so-called elite, and be able to keep up with the conversation, but not be able to verbally articulate up to a certain level because of their vocabulary and their cultural way of talking. But you could tell he had an understanding of business to the point to where, you know, with his street smarts and things of that nature, he could roll with them. You know what I mean? So, I mean, that was kind of refreshing. But he wasn't gonna go into a meeting and speak the king's language. Could he understand the king's language? To a certain level, I would think so. But whoever his partner was, his partner definitely was someone who spoke the king's language.
Well, I hope that one day, as I was looking at this, because I didn't know anything about him until hearing this, looking at one article that was done by Forbes inside FT Hustle's blueprint to become a real estate mogul, it did ask us to do one thing that I'm not hearing it being done, and it kind of touches on what you're saying, and that is making a systems analysis. Because in all the things that you said, Jay, you know, and to specifically to that other person that was a part of his team, Gross, his last
team. Yeah, the guy David Gross.
Right. And then there was others. But I think we just need to look at that, his business model,
The thing is with cats like him is they go into deals and just take a piece of the deal sometimes and build themselves up to the point where they have more control and interest within the deal and then set up partnerships. That's what he was doing. It's like, how could you say it? You know, I think y'all know this. A lot of people don't know this, but from my understanding, Kenny Gamble, he owns quite a bit of property in Philadelphia.
Yeah, I mean, he did, and it comes out of the same model. That's
hey, Jay, turn your volume down in the back. It's causing interference.
Hold on one second.
Yeah, that's 100% better. Go ahead.
Okay. So, well, from my understanding, you know, he built himself up to the point to where, as I guess, that was the type of things that the brother Nipsey was trying to do.
Well,
whole community.
Well, let me say something in reference to that, because I think that there's lessons to be learned in all of this. And it shows the struggle that we're dealing with. Now, you mentioned about this system of white supremacy that affects us all, whether we're here in the diaspora or on the continent. But we also have major struggles that we have to deal with and come up with strategies to alleviate ourselves of these problems. When I gave the example of the Ernest Withers type, that's a problem that we have to come up with a strategy. And listen, I think the strategy is already there. And we have to come up with struggles to deal with the element that did what they did to this man out there in Los Angeles. This element is in our communities. They're in our families. They're our sons, our nephews, maybe our daughters and nieces. Whatever causes this problem, whether it's the dope that's smoked on the street, other issues that they're doing, or maybe just mental illness, we're going to have to come up with strategies to deal with this, because we can't
we don't have the commitment as a people to make those type of decisions, because we don't have no base, in all honesty, to make those decisions.
Well, I mean, we're going to have to.
So you got to remember, Miles faced the same thing that you're talking about. What did he do?
Yeah, but he had a nation of people that was there, and he was the leader of that nation.
Yeah, but what I'm saying is, even though he was the leader of that nation, he still had a central place, and he still had people who believed in what he had to have them do.
Yeah, Jay, you're talking like
we divided on.
Yeah, but you're talking like this has never been done. Our people are let me finish. Our people have lived among these people since we've been here. But we've always had ways where we could control our communities.
But we have communities then. We don't have
communities. Exactly. Well,
have communities.
Yeah, now. But we can still do this. This is not like it's a monumental task that we can't do. We can take control of our communities. And by taking control of our communities, this element, whether it's the Uncle Tom type of element, the Ernest Withers type of element, or this other element that victimizes other young men, victimizes young women, victimizes the elderly, it got to be getting rid of. Both of these elements.
Nah, you're wrong, Elliot.
I'm wrong about what?
You know, I mean, you're wrong because the simple fact is we don't have communities to be able to do that, to divide it, to displace.
Yeah, but what am I wrong about when I said that we got to get rid of these elements?
You're wrong about getting rid of them.
I'm wrong about we'd have to get rid of these elements?
No, I'm saying you're wrong about getting rid of them. We got it. I agree with that. That's not even the issue. The point is, you take an example what just happened out in California with the brothers. They already know who the individual was. They already knew what the culture was and all of those things. But they couldn't remove them type of brothers within the community that were acting in these behavioral ways. Because you got to remember, the gang culture has absolutely changed from when gangs first started to the day. I'll give you a perfect example. He was talking about in one of his interviews how the whole thing changed in regards to the mass incarceration of, you know, gang members going to jail. He was saying when the gangs first started, there was no surveillance of the community, aka cell phone towers and cameras. He was saying how the old OGs were just doing their thing, shooting and all of that. But as time evolved with the cameras and the cell phone towers, when brothers were acting and behaving how the old OGs were doing it, they would get caught left and right. And then based on certain crimes, you would say, okay, your crime, you're going to be sentenced to 3 years for it. But because you may have a gang tattoo or something of that nature, because of some law that they passed about gang affiliation, they bang you with an extra 30 years. You see, so what he was trying to express was that the whole game changed and nobody that was from back in the day, because of all of the jail time that they gave and all of the deaths, were educating the youngins on what had to be done in order to stop getting caught up in it. And then that's how it became so buck wild with the murders and all the other madness that was going on. I mean, the brother was, to be honest with you, to listen to the brother had a deep understanding and analysis on how it's gotten to the point in California to where it is. Now, in the process, he was, I guess, trying to change it in certain ways, but because the culture is so crazy, he really couldn't change it. It's just like some of the behavior in New York with gangs.
Let me ask this, because it was back for me, and again, I think that we not putting him as the center, but taking all of the factors that's being raised into context and looking at it systemically. In the end, would that movement been towards sovereignty?
What movement?
Him, the economic structure that he was a part of, and I'm gonna call him, he was just a part of it, because this David Gross, this Peoples, who was a real estate agent, they were all about this placing and building Crenshaw, using Opportunity Zone as the mechanism of economic development in LA. That was, you know, that's what the vision was about. So my question
is, a basis for the development of sovereignty, because what they were trying to do was not based on constantly going to the oppressor for their salvation. They were trying to become independent on a level of, you know, going forward. But sovereignty is deeper than that.
Right, it is deeper than that. That's why I'm asking.
It's deeper
question.
Than that, but is it a part of our sovereignty? No, it's Santa Fe. Anytime you're trying to be independent of white folks, that's an element of moving towards sovereignty.
And that's the question I'm raising. Would that process been independent? And again, if we did a systems analysis and looking at, say, David Gross, as one of the elements to the structure that they were building, David Gross was tied to the Cultural Leadership Fund. The Cultural Leadership.
I don't even know if David Gross is black or white. So
he's black.
I mean,
he's black.
Okay.
Yes.
David Gross is
the co-founder and the chief investment officer of D3ND, N9.
Okay.
He is a multi-asset class investor who serves as a strategic advisor and financial steward to elite athletes, entertainers, and entrepreneurs. David is the CEO of the Confluent Group, a boutique registered investment advisor that services a select group of ultra-affluent clients. David graduated from
the question becomes this:
with a master of science of real estate development and holds an MBA.
Yeah, but the question becomes this, Richie: who's his board of directors? Who is he? Who is he associated with?
That's why I'm saying a system now, because one of the elements that comes in, that's what I'm, you know, when you so far and gathering information about and not looking at just Nipsey Hassle, but the structure that was being developed, the economic structure.
I don't know who the board is, bro.
You'll see that Mark Andrussy and Ben Holtzowitz laid out, because you see that in that.
They sound like Jews.
Right. Well, Mark Andrussy, I don't think is, but Ben Holtzowitz. But they laid out the campaign to take on Silicon Valley. Now, what they were doing was creating venture capitalists. They created a venture capital fund. Now,
Hold on one second. Let me ask you this, because I don't know if this could clear something up. Was it a venture capitalist fund for just black people, or was it, multiculturalism?
That's why I say that it takes, when you look at the people, the network that's involved, that Nipsey was involved with, and what you've seen him place on the ground as far as an economic development, and why was Crenshaw selected as a location?
That was his community. I'm looking at the
published report in relationship to them putting, not necessarily dealing with him, but the economic structure, and it was because it's in an empowerment zone. I mean, opportunity zone, and the opportunity zone.
But there's more to it than that, though.
Huh?
You have to ask yourself, why did he get involved with David Cross and go within Let me finish. I'm trying to say something, and you could answer it once I say it. You have to ask yourself this. Why did he get in touch with David Cross? Why did he bring David Cross to his community? And who was going to be beneficial to what he was doing? Was he just somebody that was being used as a tool to bring white folks into the gentrification of the community? Was there going to be a situation to that as the community was going to have jobs, better housing, and things of that nature? From what I've read so far, it just regarding him. I didn't read anything about the others. I know the name David Cross, but from what he was expressing, he said that he was trying to bring jobs to the community,
right,
trying to give offenders who had been in jail jobs. He was trying to put forward low-income housing. He was trying to build up the community and bring black businesses to the community. I didn't hear him say anything from what I've read, in regards to white people. I don't know what his intentions are. That's what I'm saying.
He was a front man. I think that he was a businessman, and he was putting a part of putting economic structure together. But I'm also saying, when you look at the other players involved, and when you not just deal with him, you'll see the structure that he was a part of. And that's why I'm asking the question, because of the other players, not only just David Gross, but also the person who was a part of the real estate, R. Donahue Pebbles, who's a black person, who is a bid to acquire the leasehold. Now, this was, they were getting ready to try to purchase a hotel in Santa Monica, the Victory Santa Monica Hotel. But this whole thing of placing the in Crenshaw, it was a strategic economic development move that they were working on from a real estate, economic development perspective, that he was not necessarily just, he was a part of a team, you know, because they were utilizing cultural matrix that he comes out of.
And, yeah, but you got to put this into context, too. Think about this. I don't know. I'll use this as an example. I don't know if Kenny Gamble had white people in his situation.
Well, it's not that he had.
No, but there's a reason why I'm saying it. Listen to what I'm saying. Now, Kenny Gamble, from what I understand, basically did the same thing that this guy was trying to do.
Right.
Because from my understanding, it was depilated in Philadelphia once Kenny started buying up all of the community, all of the property, and then building it up.
Because of the political arrangement called the empowerment zone.
I'm not saying that you're not. I'm just saying
that when looking at it, because I don't believe that's what sovereignty is. But I do agree that it is a part of it. It does provide us economic development stability in the community, in the black community, that if it was fully able to exercise itself. And you do have to engage, whether with the Opportunity Zone or with the Empowerment Zone, you have to engage with City Hall. You have to engage City Hall.
That is a part of the Salvatry, because that's not dependent on white folks or begging for white folks for anything. That's you taking advantage of your assets and your research and resources and building up. That's a part of Salvatry within this system.
Yeah. Well, let me say this. You know, you have these empowerment zones. Supposedly that was some type of national program,
right?
That is in all of these cities. Which is nothing but smoke.
Let me finish.
This whole empowerment zone thing is nothing but smoke and mirrors. So whether you're talking about in Los Angeles or in Philadelphia, when you got black capitalists that's basically in it to make money, and then you got Jewish people that's with them, we all know that, or we should know what that is.
Yeah, but that wasn't what the empowerment zone was totally about.
I don't care what it's totally about. We see what it's about in these communities. We see what it's about in these communities.
Because politicians sold us out. That's why the empowerment zone became what it was, because not the community. The politicians were the ones who sold it out.
Well, then that goes right back.
Kenny Gamble.
You keep talking about Kenny Gamble. You don't know nothing about what Kenny Gamble's doing here in Philadelphia.
I'm talking about him as an example. Kenny Gamble was able to do what he did as a black person because politicians didn't sell him out. In Harlem,
what did he do?
Because politicians sold us out.
What did he do? Kenny Gamble was able to do what he did. Build up the community. Kenny Gamble built up a couple of homes. South Philly is a huge community. Huge. Build up a couple of homes on different streets.
I'm just saying, from my understanding, didn't he build up like maybe four or five blocks or something like that?
And when he started building, the community was black. You go right around where that is gentrification, what they call in gentrification. Has occurred, and the value of those homes around and where, because that's where me and Elliot was raised in that area. I was raised below, but I live in that area now. That area has now, the value of those homes have increased, what, 10 times?
Like in Harlem. Yeah. But the point is, the reason why Harlem never had a successful community zone or anything like that was because the politicians did not deal with it on the level to where, as black people, had priority.
And when Kenny started using, Oakmont, when he started the acquisition of the houses, yes, he was able to get because there was a black mayor. But once it hit to a certain point, then it got a pushback because then when the black mayor left. Because the infrastructure of a city hall ain't black, even though, and it was told by the time it was at the third man.
Even if it was black.
Mike Street, when he said, this is a black city, and they slapped him and said, you can't say that.
Right.
This is a top city. And they slapped him. They said, you can't say that, because they know who controls the bureaucracies. And it was the bureaucracies that actually said, Kenny, you starting to get, I see you getting these here properties from the politician, the black politicians, for nothing. Which
did black politicians economic capitulate and sell you out? Because they don't have no desire to see black folks succeed and be in an equal or a dominant position over white people. They want white people to always be the overseer. So you can understand that. Now, I don't know what the situation is in California. I'm just going on what one sees in the basis of what their commitment is to the community and how the community is in play for its growth and development. But the reality is, a black politician will sell your black ass out every chance they black politician is no friend to black people. They have no desire for us.
Can I ask a question?
I think Otis came in. Hello?
I just want to ask a quick question while y'all are talking. I hear a lot of facts being run around, but I'm going to go back to one of the first questions you asked that might put all this dialogue to rest about whether or not what we're seeing is the very same thing that we talked about one of the first times I called into this program. Branding has been a method used to deceive us as a people for as long as we've been here. Same thing with Magic Johnson's AMC theaters, same thing with Revolt, same thing with Al Sharpton on MSNBC. Let me explain something to you. Darden didn't just happen to be this man's lawyer that took out this brother that was the face of gentrification in one of the most high-profile intersections in that area. I'm going to say it again. You've been talking around some facts. But if you stop and look at the forest instead of the trees, you're going to find out these opportunity zones were set up with minimal requirements for investors. And I can tell you without doing this, the down to the level of the county clerk, that I doubt Nipsey Hussle had the kind of money to be able to go in and buy this stuff alone. I'm going to say it again. Branding. It's been a tool, even when you're talking about Kenny Gamble. He might have done four or five blocks, but I can tell you, the man has figured out how to protect his game. Gamble may have done four or five blocks, but he didn't do it with his own money, and that's a fact. You can go back and look at the last 20 years of articles that have leaked about his corruption and how people got properties that were set aside, and nobody understands why it didn't go through the city's processes and everything. So I'm going to leave it at that again. Darden is not doing a pro bono case, and by the time you figure out how he's going to get paid, it's going to be the same names that you just read off that are investors in the corporation that fronted for Nipsey Hussle. Have a good day, gentlemen.
All right. Thanks.
They always say it's about association, right? Richard and Elliot, it's who you associated with. It's who you're able to be part of a deal. I mean, if we're going to talk about Magic Johnson, that's how Magic Johnson became as wealthy as he was, based on association. You know? So, I mean, hey, that's it looks like that's what the deal. I know in Harlem, you know, there was a time when you could do certain things, and now you can't do them because you're not associated with them. I mean, you know, Charlie Rangel, the so-called great leader, hey, man, he sold Harlem out. To whereas now, you know, there's only a few blacks that own things. I mean, none of the real estate that I'm involved with is in Harlem. I mean, hey, I just live in Harlem. You know, I lucked up. But, I mean, the reality is I can't get a piece of property in Harlem. I mean, it would cost too much. Now, 30 years ago, could have got some nice property, you know? But, hey, that's just the reality. But I will say this, and I'll leave it at this. I think even if the brother Nipsey was in association with others, I take my hat off to him that he had a vision. He had a pretty decent idea on what he was trying to accomplish for the community, and hopefully, you know, they'll be able to move forward, and his vision will move forward. Will the people that were backing him, will they find some other person, or will the so-called community in Compton come together and join forces and continue his work? But listen, man, y'all have a beautiful weekend. Richard, don't use your keys, and Elliot, don't cut too many heads. We see y'all on Sunday. Be good, brother.
All right. Yeah. Let's go to 215.
Hey, brother Elliot, how you doing?
How are you, sir?
I'm doing fine. Hey, brother Richard, how you doing, my brother?
Yeah.
Praise be to Allah. Good show tonight, Elliot and Richard, as usual, man. Following Jay and brother Otis, tough act to follow, man. But did I heard brother Otis right when he was talking about Nipsey Hussle about. He didn't say he hadn't. Cause I want to make sure I didn't put the right thing out there. I must have misunderstood, brother. He didn't say that Nipsey Hussle was dealt with a Trump associate. That's what he said.
Built a what?
That Nipsey Hussle and his dealings out there, that he was dealt with somebody that was associated with Donald Trump.
No.
Okay, I'm going to say this. I just want to make sure. I didn't think so. I just want to clarify that. Thanks, Richard. Just want to clarify that. Yeah, I feel bad about the brother's death, man. You know, that's why, you know, this stuff that escalate with brothers that into a personal beef where cause I don't know the whole situation, what happened behind his death, but I know this foolishness, you know, is tearing our communities apart across the country. These things that escalate where you feel the need to take somebody's life in such a cold, egregious manner. I mean, you know, this fratricide or self-hatred among our people is something that definitely has to be dealt with. And it has to be talked about and come up with remedies, Brother Rich and Brother Elliot, to deal with these things, because it's definitely a stain on our community. And I hope it's something, you know, that we, as the time progresses, we can help, you know, do our best to resolve these things, you know, squash these beefs among brothers where they can see that they can settle their differences without having to feel the need to kill somebody. Like the late Rob Murray used to say on terrestrial radio when he had the show, you know, put down the gun, pick up the gloves, and you tough and you bad, you know, fight it out with your fist. That way everybody go home alive, you know what I'm saying?
So. Yeah, well, I mean, Joe, I mean, that's what I raised at the beginning when this issue was, when we were talking about this issue. Whatever he was trying to do in Los Angeles, I don't know because I'm not there.
Mm-hmm.
He's not here to do it anymore. And
right.
he's not here to do it anymore because an element in the community is an element, like you said, that's in other communities around the country. The same element that did it is the same element that'll come in your mother's house,
mm-hmm.
And hit her upside the head and rob her, maybe kill her. That'll do that to your grandfather if he walking down the street.
Mm-hmm.
That's an element that we have to get rid of in these communities.
No question, brother.
I mean, I'm not. Listen, I don't care whether the guy was trying to build 20 homes in Los Angeles or 20 businesses. Mm-hmm. He's not here to do it anymore because
that's right.
And that element is not dealt with. It's going to be a problem. It is a problem. Not going to be a problem. It's a problem in our communities. It's got to be dealt with.
Ellie, I'm making it clear, you know, to all the Time for the Wicked listening audience, Brother Jay, Brother Otis, and anybody that's listening in the audience. See, I'm very clear on that. You know, I love our people, but I do realize, Brother Ellie, it's some Negroes in our community is going to have to be dealt with. And I'm just going to be straight up with you. Some of these Negroes need to get their damn heads chopped off. These Negroes that you can't talk to, you can't reason with, that got so far gone that they just hell-bent on terrorizing our people, like you said, Elliot, our sisters, our brothers, whereas our children can't sit out and play and stuff, and saw some fool coming up and down, she's shooting some drug deal going sour, like you said, home invasion, where you come in there and rob and rape and sodomize an 80, 90-year-old woman. See, this kind of stuff, it's not a lot. No civilized society going to let this go on. And I'm making it very clear, unapologetically, some of these Negroes going to literally have to get their damn heads chopped off so the other thug Negroes, the Mookie Ray Rays, get their message that, look, we're not tolerating this stuff. So either they're going to clean ship up or shape out, buddy. Simple as that. Clear. I can't say no more but clear than that, Brother Elliot. But let's move on, Elliot, before, you know, because Richard's trying to get out of here. AOC, Cortez, I don't know if you heard her. I was listening to conservative radio. And sometimes, you know, you pass by them bigots and they be talking crazy, but sometimes they put stuff out there that's useful that we can keep an eye on. They was upset with her because she made a speech the other day, and she said it. She said, look, she said a white man, well, she didn't use the term white, but you know where she was coming from. She said, well, America is always on the wrong side of things when it comes to dealing rights. She said this country was on the wrong side of slavery. They said they're on the wrong side of the economic divide with a 1% getting everything while other people struggling to make ends meet. She was talking about, you know, staying with they're on the wrong side of civil rights. America is always on the wrong side of things. But what got the right wing upset on the conservative talk show when AOC said about how she was pointing about, and I give a sister credit for critiquing her own party. She said, look, as a Democrat, she says, she talked about Robert Byrd, the racist bigot Democrat senator from West Virginia who was a Naval Ku Klux Klan leader, who some black people still, for whatever reason, hold in high regard. He was a Klansman. So you know, as a Klansman, you know how he, if he didn't participate in the killing or sanction of black men, he sure as hell knew what was going on. So, because that's just the nature of being a Ku Klux Klansman. But yet, because he allegedly had this a change of heart late in his life, which I know, which I'm not buying, and stuff like that. For some reason, black folks think that devil's some kind of great man when he ain't never a little racist SOB. And she critiqued Al Gore, the former vice president, his father, Al Gore Sr., who's a senator from Tennessee. And as you know, he voted against the Civil Rights Bill. So basically AOC was saying, as a Democrat, she said, I'm clear on how the Republicans, how they feel in her history. She said, well, we can't let the Democrats off the hook either. She said, because they're racist white men are no more less racist than the white ones are in the Republican Party. So bottom line was, she was saying, both of y'all are a bunch of bigots and stuff. Y'all history speaks for itself. You know, that's what my brother Malcolm was saying. You know, don't sit there and, like Malcolm said on that tape you and Richard play, LA, where he said, don't call this what Malcolm said, don't call this no Senate filibuster. Well, he said, because it's done on the Senate floor. Hey, this is an American thing, you know what I mean? Malcolm said, don't try to act like it's a Dixiecrat thing. It's like Malcolm was saying, you had both sides voting against certain things that would help black people. And that's what AOC was saying. Y'all both a bunch of bigots and stuff like that. Because like I said, all one has to do is look at the two former presidents and stuff. Bill Clinton, Democrat. George Bush W., the late president. Like I say, they were so-called bitter rivals when they were running, but after they left office, them devils hung around each other. Like you said, bankrupt Haiti, did all that crooked shit together and everything like that. So at the end of the day, Democrat, Republican, them devils, they side with each other because they're all about maintaining white domination, white superiority, and white racism around the world, no matter whether they're Democrat or Republican. That's why you notice Ellen Rich, the right wing, they don't attack Joe Biden for the most part, because don't forget, Joe Biden, not only is he a serial woman grabber, but he also was to help create a crime bill, Joe Biden.
Mm-hmm.
And if you heard that speech that he made several years ago, his speech was worse than Hillary's with the super predators, worse than Hillary. And you know Hillary's was bad, Ellen Richie, you know that, right? But Joe Biden's was worse. Those people, these people, protecting them from them animals, from attacking my mother, your mother. I mean, there's all kinds of stuff this devil was saying. And who could ever forget Joe Biden's infamous comment several years ago when he was in vice president, where he said, yeah, y'all better vote for us Democrats because the Republicans, they're going to put your people back in chains and all that stuff. And he laughed about it like it was some kind of joke, you know what I mean? So you know where his head is at, you know? So just let us out, people know, hey, that when you go vote for these people, understand what you're voting for, and like you said, be an educated voter. Know where these people's coming from. Don't go in there blindly because he's a Democrat, thinking that he's some kind of you know vanguard for black people, because he's not. Joe Biden's history speaks for itself. Just like you say, if you're going to say George Bush and Trump's history speaks for itself, which you know it does, then sure as hell Joe Biden speaks for itself. So just be clear when you go be an educated voter, because too often times we like the blind sheep leading blind sheep, because these handkerchief-haired pork-chopping preachers tell us to vote for these certain individuals. We just go pull that Democrat lever, vote blindly, not even acknowledging the bigotry coming out of a lot of these people's minds. And don't forget Joe Biden. You think Trump and all of them is pro-Israel and pro-Zionist. Joe Biden never met a Zionist he didn't like. So let's keep that in mind, okay? So, you know, but anyway, Brother Ellen Richard, thank you for your time, brothers. I'll let y'all brothers go because I'm trying to wind it down. But, you know, thanks for giving me the time. I'll talk to y'all brothers on Sunday.
All right, now.
Thanks, Ellen. Thanks, Richard. Mm-hmm.
Richard, coming up on the end of another program, man. Again, I want to thank Brother Isaiah and Joku of the Black Student Union out there in UCLA for being with us, sharing what's going on out there with our students out there at the University of California at Los Angeles. Let me read that article, the announcement that was sent, and I'll go into a little more detail on Sunday. From Brother Ezra Alarone out there in Delaware State. And I'm going to forward it to you, Richard, because I don't think I forwarded it to you.
No.
The Delaware State University and our Center for Global Africa invite you and you to our first annual Pan-African Development Conference, April 10th to the 12th, 2019, at Delaware State University campus in Dover, Delaware, in conjunction with our strategic partner, the African Peer Review Mechanism of the African Union. We will gather top economic, top academic, media, and political stakeholders of the diaspora to create and strengthen functional ties with Africa through HBCU expertise and partnerships. The conference and vision of the GCA coincide with the recognition of the 400-year mark, 1619 to 2019, of the transatlantic slave trade, and the subsequent 21st century need to structurally combine and apply our resources and expertise towards common ideals and institutional collaborations for mutual progress. Our diverse guests will be Robert Cool Bell of Cool and the Gang and baseball legend Dusty Baker, who recently formed the Cool Baker Global Incorporated to bring new renewable energy projects to Africa. And Samaya Nkrumah will make a special presentation to the life and Pan-African legacy of her father, Kwame Nkrumah, Ghana's first president. The conference events and panel discussions with the distinguished African and diaspora experts will include presentations to Delaware State University, to mobilize diaspora resources, partnerships, and business developments in Africa, expertise in industrial experts in energy, agriculture, and technology, and innovations, presentations to utilize the 21st century media platforms to promote student-driven Pan-African initiatives, information, and joining the academic, economic, and governmental partnership of Delaware State University. For further information, you can email Delaware State at DSU APRMINFO at DSU.edu or telephone Dr. Kwasi Owasa at 302-857-6625. Professor Ezra Alarone at 302-857-6627, or Professor Leandra Kaysen at 302-612-2052. The Black Students Day there, Black Student Union, Richard, formed a black think tank.
And you said they did?
They did. Yeah, they have one there at the school.
Mm-hmm.
And, in fact, it's under their mission statement. The mission and vision of their group. I'll go into a little more detail Sunday when I kind of share it. And in fact, I'll forward it to you so you can see it. So there's a lot of things going on in some of our college campuses.
Mm-hmm.
And it's necessary for our people to know what our children are doing on these campuses. They're really preparing. Some of them to move our people forward. We got to do all we can to help them, to showcase them. That's why I try to, whenever I find out that students are doing something on these campuses, I try to reach out to them and have them on the program to let our listening audience know exactly what's going on and exactly what they're doing.
Sounds good.
We'll be looking forward to Sunday's program. I want to thank everybody for listening to the program this evening. Lively discussion, as always, and we'll be back on Sunday, Lord willing, to continue on this path towards an awakening. Peace.
Peace.
If you're driving through the country on a lazy afternoon,
children playing after school. They seem to be so unaware. I know the things that they'll soon have to take care of. We've got to do something, yeah, to save the children. Soon it will be their turn to try and save the world. Right now they seem to play such a small part of.
To save the children.